Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
It's the Brian Lehrer Show. Good morning. I'm Kai Wright, sitting in for Brian today. There is lots to talk about after an eventful and disturbing weekend in Charlottesville, Virginia. In case you've somehow missed it, to quickly recap, a group of avowed white supremacists, neo-Nazis, and varied alt-right groups converged on the town to protest the city council's decision to remove a statue of Confederate General Robert E. Lee. They marched through the University of Virginia campus on Friday night, but I believe carrying lit torches, chanting, "Jews will not replace us," and "White lives matter," among other sentiments. They had planned a rally at the statue on Saturday morning, but as they gathered and counter-protesters arrived to reject the white nationalist sentiments, violence pretty quickly erupted. There is a lot of debate about whether police acted quickly enough. Governor Terry McAuliffe points out that the white nationalists were armed with a disturbing amount of weaponry and that the police worked to defuse things without a massacre, frankly. Nonetheless, dozens were injured and three people died. 32-year-old Heather Heyer was killed when white nationalist protester James Fields Jr., a 20-year-old man who had come to the event from Ohio, drove his car into a crowd in what has accurately been described as an act of terrorism. Two police officers were killed when their helicopter crashed while patrolling the event. Richard Spencer, who was amongst the organizers and is a national figure in the white nationalist movement, is credited with coining the term alt-right. He declared the whole thing a moral victory for his movement. Elected officials across the spectrum, however, both national and local, roundly denounced the march organizers, blamed them for the violence. But of course, with the notable exception of the President of the United States, who instead said he regrets violence on, quote, many sides. Here are his remarks about the event.
But we're closely following the terrible events unfolding in Charlottesville, Virginia. We condemn in the strongest possible terms this egregious display of hatred, bigotry, and violence on many sides. On many sides. It's been going on for a long time in our country. Not Donald Trump, not Barack Obama. It's been going on for a long, long time.
So this is not the kind of unequivocal, harsh language that we are accustomed to hearing from the president on things that he does not condone of. Several Republicans have joined a chorus of people noting that his equivocation is shocking and distasteful. On Sunday, the White House issued a statement to the press pool not attributed directly to the president, which condemned, quote, white supremacists for the violence. And the president has sent a few tweets expressing sympathy for the people who died over the weekend and one that says, quote, "We must remember this truth no matter our color, creed, religion, or political party. We are all Americans first." But nothing specifically calling out the white nationalist groups who marched this weekend. Events are still unfolding in Charlottesville and in Washington as the administration tries to control the fallout from the president's remarks. And joining me to discuss all of this is Cheryl Gay Stolberg of The New York Times, who was in Charlottesville this weekend, and Perry Bacon Jr. of 538. Welcome to you both.
Thanks for having me.
So listeners, as we have this conversation, in the absence of the president saying much about the violence, we're wondering, how did you process what happened? How did you talk about it with friends, with clergy at faith service? What did you take away from it? Give us a call and share your thoughts. 212-433-WNYC. That's 212-433-9692. And perhaps food for thought in that is a tweet from New Yorker writer Jelani Cobb, who wrote, "The biggest indictment of the way we teach American history is that people can look at Charlottesville and say, quote, this is not who we are." So if the violent clashes there are who we are as a nation, do you think so? Where do we get, and if so, where do we go from there? 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. And Cheryl, let's start with you. What was the scene there on Saturday? We've read a lot about it, but since you were there, what struck you most? What did you see?
Well, it was mayhem. I mean, it was just outright brawling, people clubbing one another with bats, people throwing pepper, people shooting, you know, or spraying pepper spray, throwing water bottles and water balloons filled with urine. I was in the middle of this crowd. I actually got sprayed with urine. It was most unpleasant, but just terrible, terrible violence, physical violence. It was an all-out, very dangerous brawl in front of the park where the Lee statue is.
And how did what I can't wrap my head around is really how the violence began. What really sort of set it off?
Well, what set it off was the very existence of the white nationalist, white supremacist groups that were trying to make their way into this park. In Charlottesville, there's a park called Emancipation Park, formerly Lee Park, because the statue of Robert E. Lee is there. And the white supremacists had a permit to rally inside the park. The park was surrounded by barricades, and inside the barricades, there was a line of police. But there weren't police on Market Street, the street fronting the park. On Market Street, there was a line of militiamen, self-styled militiamen in camouflage with assault rifles, and behind them a line of clergy singing and praying, and behind the clergy, hundreds, thousands of counter-demonstrators, some of whom, just like the white supremacists, had come dressed for battle in helmets, with shields, and with bats and clubs. And so as the white supremacists were trying to make their way into the park, people were attacking them, skirmishes were growing more and more violent, and when the governor finally declared a state of emergency at 11:22 in the morning, police tried to clear the park, and they declared an unlawful assembly. The white nationalists exited the park, and they were being attacked and clubbed by the so-called Antifa, the counter-protesters with bats, and the white nationalists were clubbing back. It was just all-out mayhem. Mm-hmm.
And what about this debate over the law enforcement's response? You sort of describe where the police were in relationship to these militia people who had assault rifles. What was your impression of whether the police responded rapidly enough and appropriately? What did that look like to you?
Well, I think we're going to have this debate over how the police responded for a long time to come, and there will be after-action reports. Yesterday, I interviewed Virginia's Governor Terry McAuliffe about this. He said he was very proud of the police response. He noted that there were, apart from the very tragic death of the woman who was mowed down by a car, which he said could not have been prevented, he said there were no other deaths, and he said that it was incumbent upon the police to clear the park so that the riot police could move in. But you had people there stunned, absolutely just slack-jawed at the fact that the police were inside this park witnessing these brawls and not doing anything to stop it. So I think we're going to hear a lot of questioning about what the police did and didn't do and what they should have done.
Why do you think that is? I mean, it's because it is an alarming idea that somehow the police were just letting it happen, particularly given that this was, you know, not just any violence, but racially motivated violence. What is your sense of what they were trying to do, or what did the governor say they were trying to achieve?
I don't know exactly why that is. I was not in the police planning sessions, of course, but I suspect that the officers who were in the park were not equipped with riot gear. They were uniformed officers, and perhaps they felt it was too dangerous for them to intervene in these brawls with bats and clubs if they weren't going to get involved in bats and clubs of their own. The riot police were kind of on the outskirts. They were holding back, perhaps so as not to inflame the situation with their presence. I don't know this. I'm not an expert on police tactics. But, you know, what wound up happening was the riot police, who were really able to break up the crowd and who were dressed for battle, did not move in until things got out of hand.
Mm-hmm. Perry, I want to bring you in here. I wanted to just sort of get Cheryl to lay the land for us there for a bit. But you wrote today that, you know, there's a broader sense in the conservative movement that white identity is under attack in some way, that it's not just this sort of extreme articulation that we saw today or saw this weekend from explicit white nationalists. Can you talk about that a little bit? What were you trying to say in your piece today?
Yeah, I was writing about this idea that one of the chants you heard over the weekend was, I mean, we've had white supremacist groups for a long time. We've had white nationalism in this country for a long time. What I was writing about was one of the things that was interesting that people were chanting was White Lives Matter. I don't think people would have chanted that in 2009 or 2000 or 1998. And I think that specific idea goes to the fact that we had this big movement in the country around Black Lives Matter. And you've seen some of that rhetoric been taken up by whites and groups saying that, you know, in the country we live in today, and I've heard this idea expressed some, in the country we live in today, we have a Black Lives Matter movement, and yet we already have a Black president. We have lots of, you know, very powerful Black figures. And so their view is to some extent that whiteness is under attack and that white identity should be defended in the same way that Black or any other identity is. And I think you're hearing some of that over the weekend. And I think you get to the point where if you think about White Lives Matter and Black Lives Matter as being sort of competing and equivalent movements, I think that gets you toward where Donald Trump is coming from when he wants to sort of be on all sides or many sides of the issue.
And there's polling data that sort of backs this up, right? I mean, what does some of that data show us?
Yeah, we looked at some data, and what it shows is if you look at the public overall, what it finds is the public overall thinks that Muslims, African Americans, and LGBT people particularly face higher levels of discrimination in America. But if you look at, and Democrats, of course, feel that way, obviously, but if you look at Republicans, which you'll find in a fair number of polls, is Republicans feel that whites and Christians are facing discrimination at much higher rates than the public or Democrats feel. In other words, a fair amount of Republicans feel that being white and being a Christian are also under attack in our country, and view to some extent that Blacks and Muslims, that the discrimination they face is kind of overstated in some ways.
Cheryl, we got a tweet that said, quote, "It was Antifa that caused the chaos." Antifa being the anti-fascist group you mentioned. Can you give a sense of what is your sense of that?
I would say Antifa participated in the chaos, but certainly I don't see how you can say Antifa caused the chaos when the very presence of these white nationalists and white supremacist groups who themselves came dressed and armed for battle and who were chanting, you know, hateful slogans like, "You will not replace us, Jews will not replace us." You know, I think, I guess I would say, you know, far extremes of both sides participated in a very violent melee.
But an event that is framed in violence in the first place, that preceded by a march with torchlights, evocative of Klan rallies.
Exactly. I mean, this was a very, you know, think about that. Think about the spectacle of hundreds of white nationalists parading on the campus of the University of Virginia Friday night with torches. This is a very, very intimidating act. This is an act that evokes memories of the Ku Klux Klan, which lynched and killed, you know, Black people in this part of the country with impunity. You know, these are not people who came here with sweetness and light.
Let's get some callers into this. I want to bring in Raymond from the Bronx. Raymond, hello. You're on the air.
Yes, thank you. Listen, my question is, and, you know, my family, we were looking at it and was saying, like, okay, people came dressed, you know, to riot. I mean, they dressed in military gear. What are they looking for? Now, I respect their, you know, the national movement in a sense that, you know, Robert E. Lee or the Southerners, that was a part of our history. I mean, now Blacks are going to be angry. I'm an Afro-American. That's a part of our history. That's not going to change. So the statues and the other memorials of those people are part of our history, period. It's not going to change anything. And I think that America's movement now towards this hatred and this division is dangerous, and it's not American. You can't even say that we're America anymore with the type of attitudes that we have today. And I'm ashamed to be. I'm a veteran. I'm a war veteran, and I'm a veteran, and I'm ashamed.
Thank you, Raymond. I'm going to move through a few of these so we can hear a bunch of voices, and then we'll talk about it. Let's hear from Dolores in Bradley Beach, New Jersey.
I just wanted to comment on the earlier statement, is this who we are as Americans? And unfortunately, I believe it is. I think that there is a large segment of our population that did not feel as comfortable to come out and explicitly to present their hatred, their bigotry of the other. And it's basically, it's just the other. It's whoever isn't you. And I think that we have to figure out a way to come together. And if we don't, if our administration, you know, our president doesn't even come out and condemn this, and that condemn racism and bigotry, how are we going to move that in that direction?
Dolores,
we need to move in that direction.
Dolores, can I ask you, what is the answer to that question that you raise? You know, it seems, you know, if the polling and the analysis that we've heard from Perry is true, it seems that it's clear that the president has very clear political reasons not to lead this conversation. So then what is the way forward when we have events like this?
You're asking me what the
way
forward
is?
Yeah,
I'm asking you what you think of the answer.
The way forward is that we have to not allow it to become this violent. It has to be stopped before it moves to this point. And we have to have an open dialogue in this country where we accept and understand that there is a tremendous amount of the population that are racist.
Thanks.
And just putting it under the rug and saying, if you vote for someone who condones racism, then you're a racist. It isn't as if you're not a racist because you didn't, you know, I personally get along with people of other denominations or whatever. If you vote for someone who condones racism, that is a form of racism, and you are not moving forward as a country.
Thank you for that, Dolores.
Thank you.
Cheryl, I wonder, hearing both of those callers and particularly Dolores' remarks, that you've been covering race and racial tension in America for some time. And coming off of a weekend like this, I just wonder where your thoughts are in terms of the road forward and where we stand.
I'm going to tell you what comes to mind when I hear that. What comes to mind for me is a moment during the 2016 presidential race when I was reporting on a black neighborhood in Philadelphia. And we were talking a lot about some of the hateful rhetoric that was coming out of the alt-right during the presidential campaign, this kind of neo-Nazi rhetoric. And some black people there said to me, but they were actually glad that this kind of rhetoric was coming out because now the rest of America could see what they themselves knew was already there. And that only by seeing and understanding that this kind of sentiment exists in our country can we confront and suppress it. And I guess that's kind of where I come down. I'd be interested to hear what Perry has to say about this.
What do you think, Perry?
You know, I do think we're having a kind of a more open discussion. I'm not sure I'm going to say it's good or bad, but it's definitely more. I mean, we've seen, you know, one thing that's inspiring that we should make sure to talk about is the fact that the debate here is about taking down Confederate monuments. And this spring earlier, we had there was a governor's contest in Virginia in the Republican primary between a pretty establishment Republican who used to work for George W. Bush named Ed Gillespie and then a man named Corey Stewart. And one of his big campaign platforms was he would oppose taking down Confederate monuments in Virginia. Everyone thought Gillespie, the more establishment candidate, would blow out Stewart. Stewart nearly almost won the race, you know, campaigning by defending Confederate monuments, essentially. We now have a candidate in South Carolina who's running for governor who is saying, I'm a proud daughter of the Confederacy. This is a woman saying this, who's running for governor in South Carolina. So I think we are seeing, you know, we're having a real discussion now. I think the Obama years in a lot of ways kind of gave people a sense of kind of racial harmony and unity, except until Ferguson, I would say. And I think now we're having a real sort of open discussion in which we're really talking about the issue, which is that America is becoming less white and less Christian. And you're seeing some backlash to that. And there's a big debate now about kind of what it means to be American and what is American history. Can you celebrate the Confederacy and Confederate monuments in the kind of America we're moving toward? I think we're having that real debate right now. And I think Saturday was very ugly. So I'm not going to suggest that it's necessarily good we're having these candidates in this way. But I think we are talking about the real issues right now.
Yeah,
and I would echo what Perry just said, that it was ugly and we should remember that.
And I should note that we will later in the show talk with Brian Stevenson about specifically about the question of not only Confederate monuments, but what other kinds of monuments there ought to be. So that's coming up later. I want to bring in Gilda from Roosevelt Island. Hi, Gilda. You're on the air.
Hi. What has impressed me the most about what transpired over the weekend and the president's lack of response or adequate response is why anybody is even asking that question, because if anybody has read, as I have, Josh Green's book about Bannon and his background, it should be so obvious that he has surrounded himself, I'm not talking about his generals, but about the other positions, the Steve Millers, the Bannon and the Hungarian Nazi Sebastian Gorka, plus who knows how many others that we still don't know the names of, who are alt-right people. And it's so clear in, from Josh's books that that is who is filling up the White House and who the president wants to be surrounded by.
Certainly, there's certainly Steve Bannon is credited with relaunching Breitbart and with a explicit effort to reach the alt-right audience. And that has certainly had political ramifications for President Trump. And I wonder, Perry, well, both Perry and Cheryl, whether or not there's some discussion about that, however, that this might be a turning point, that that because of the way in which Republicans have responded to the president's sort of equivocation on the violent Saturday and the belief that that equivocation grows out of the Steve Bannons and the Stephen Millers in his political coalition, whether or not this is sort of a moment where either he's going to have to break with them or the Republicans are going to break with him. Do either of you have a sense of whether that's the case? Do you have, what are your thoughts on that?
I mean, I guess I would say I often feel like we overstate the importance of presidential advisors. Like, Donald Trump employs Steve Bannon. Steve Bannon does not employ Donald Trump. And so in that sense, I would say, I don't really care if Steve Bannon works at the White House or not. It's not like at the end of this, you have to think about these last 2 days. Donald Trump is the person who's the president. He's had ample opportunities to say, I deplore white supremacy, period. He's choosing not to do that. I think if Steve Bannon, whether he works there or not, I think Donald Trump may still choose not to make that unequivocal statement. So I would put this much more on Donald Trump. And I'm not sure if Steve Bannon's fired next week. My understanding is Steve Bannon and other advisors at the White House have lots of disagreement on lots of other issues as well. So Steve Bannon may be gone in 6 months. I'm not sure if Donald Trump's political instincts will change because, I mean, Donald Trump did lead the birther movement before Steve Bannon worked for him. So I think we have to consider Donald Trump's context. I would want to say it was very striking this weekend to watch the gap between Paul Ryan, Mitch McConnell, Tom Cotton, Marco Rubio, Jeb Bush. On Sunday, even Mike Pence and Ivanka Trump were fairly unequivocal about criticizing white supremacy. So you almost have Donald Trump and maybe Bannon in a kind of an island by themselves, even in the Republican Party, even in their own White House.
But I will... I will say that, you know, I mean, we've been following the alt-right and the white supremacist movement ourselves through our United States of Anxiety Project. And, you know, and if you look at the Daily Stormer and some of those publications that are their voices, they have been very excited about the president's response. Cheryl, you were trying to get in there.
I was going to say, yeah, so not only has Donald Trump not denounced white supremacists, but just this morning, he has criticized on Twitter the African-American CEO of Merck Pharmaceuticals, who quit a federal advisory panel in protest of Mr. Trump's response to the violence in Charlottesville. So he's taking it one step further. And separate and apart from that, you asked, are we at a turning point? I think we may well be at a turning point. We are seeing the leaders of this alt-right movement, people like Richard Spencer, say, basically, you ain't seen nothing yet. Spencer said that they would be back in Charlottesville, that what they plan to do here in the future will make people's heads spin. I think that what happened here this weekend has left the alt-right, the white nationalists and supremacists, feeling very emboldened. My colleagues Richard Fawcett and Alan Foyer have a great story in today's paper that sort of picks apart, analyzes the white nationalist movement, and they say, they report that the white nationalists are claiming victory after this weekend.
They're certainly resurgent. There is no debating. If you talk to folks like the Southern Poverty Law Center and others that track this movement, you know, they have told us that if, you know, we asked them about this movement even 5 years ago, certainly, you know, 10 years ago, they would have said it's dying out. It's, you know, it's peopled by old white men who are losing their luster and are struggling to gain momentum, whereas now it has erupted, particularly in the last 2 years, with new money and new energy driven by millennials online. It's a shocking change.
I was very struck by the presence of millennials at the protests here within the alt-right group. You know, not surprising that they were largely men, almost exclusively men, but I was kind of surprised at the age. Not like old KKK types, but young, energized millennial men.
You mentioned Richard Spencer's vow to come back to Charlottesville. What's the feeling there amongst officials you talk to or people in the community about that, and whether or not, you know, the moment of danger is done? What are folks feeling like there?
You know, I think I think the feeling here is that they're all just still a little bit reeling and figuring out, you know, just trying to catch their breath. The driver of the car is having a bail hearing in court here today, and we haven't heard too much from the mayor or the city manager. We've heard more from the governor and state officials and city officials. I think they are really wrestling here in this city with how to reconcile free speech and public safety. This is something that the mayor said to us in an interview yesterday. How do you square those two? They tried to do it here in Charlottesville. Obviously, it didn't work, certainly not for the safety of the public.
Yeah. And but there, you're still there. So there are, do you still see folks from either side of this in town? Are there still
no,
sort of
I mean, the state police were cleared out of downtown. No, I didn't see any riot police this morning. There's more media than anyone else. There's still a memorial of flowers laid out on the street where the woman was killed. Over at Emancipation Park, the barricades were down this morning. The park sidewalks are splattered with dye, purple and pink dye that was kind of mixed in with those water bottles and water balloons. But the city feels quiet this morning.
Purple and pink dye? I'm sorry, I didn't follow that. That was
with... They were in the water balloons and the water bottles. I guess they were filled with this kind of, they were like paint bombs that were being thrown. Honestly, it was very hard for me to see, but I know that I got spattered with one in the midst of the unrest on Friday and on Saturday, rather. And the sidewalks, you can see it all along the sidewalks. They're just spattered with this dye that was being used as kind of a weapon in the melee.
I'm going to just squeeze in a couple more callers before we have to close this out, because we have so many people that do want to comment on this. Linnell in Brooklyn, welcome. You're on the air.
Hi. So I just wanted to respond to the caller's answer regarding the police being in riot gear and why they didn't intervene more. I find it very ironic that when it's a Black Lives Matter protest or just any kind of protest where the protesters are predominantly Black, the police are in riot gear before the event even starts, and they're geared up for what they think is going to be trouble, even when it's a peaceful march. But when it's white supremacists or white nationalists or whatever you want to call them, the police are not in riot gear, or the ones that are in riot gear are not in the center of what's going on and are practicing restraint. And I, you know, honestly can only think of one reason why that would be.
We received a similar tweet about the Women's March in D.C. and all of the rules that, that march organizers had about what you could carry versus all of the sort of weaponry that folks showed up with at this alt-right march, Linnell. So your other people are having the same sort of reaction to this.
Okay.
Thanks for your thoughts. Lynn in Flushing, Queens.
Good morning. I just wanted to say that as a Jew, having Gorka and Miller and people who are openly anti-Semitic on his so-called team is very upsetting, and that these people were Nazi signs. They don't just hate Jews. They hated everyone. They hated everyone who wasn't them. And so these groups are the same. They hate anyone that's not them.
Yeah. Well, thank you for that thought, Lynn. We're going to have to wrap this up. I just wanted to squeeze one more in there. Thank you to Cheryl Gay Stolberg of the New York Times and Perry Bacon Jr. of 538. Cheryl, you're still in Charlottesville, correct?
I am.
Please stay safe down there.
Thank you. It should be very safe here today.
Okay.
It's a lovely little city. I went to school here.
Oh, okay. Well, you're back home then. Thanks to both of you for joining us. We're going to take a break, and when we get back, we will discuss the other news that is disturbing to many people this weekend, the developments with North Korea.